Hello again, and welcome to Gamification Unlocked, a show about real games and how we can use their techniques for learning and change. My name is Brandon Carper. I'm a training designer.
And I'm Chad Haefeli. I work in libraries doing user experience stuff.
And today we are talking about Gone Home, a game published in 2013. It's the 12th highest rated PC game on Metacritic for that year. Metacritic being the site that aggregates ratings for movies, video games, and all sorts of things. It also won the Games of Change Game of the Year Award in 2014. And it's very similar to Life is Strange, somewhat, in terms of theme. It's a story about teenage girls in the Pacific Northwest exploring homosexuality, and also photography plays a role.
That's going to be our theme as a podcast, I think. It's just games with photography.
Well, I was talking with my wife, and she suggested we call our show FeministWalkingSimulatorGames.com.
Oh, man, I would totally listen to that.
Which would have made our search for a URL a little bit easier. But anyway, the story of the game is that you play a 21-year-old woman named Caitlin who returns home from a year abroad to a mansion that her family has inherited in the meantime. But even though Caitlin is home, everyone is gone, including mom, dad, and her 18-year-old sister, Sam.
And also, it's what, 1995?
Also, it's 1995. Thank you, Chad. I forgot that.
Which means no cell phone. She can't just call and say, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, that's true. Cell phones are very annoying as a plot device. Mm-hmm. In more contemporary stories. So she comes home, she doesn't know where anyone is, and basically the game is you walking through the house as Caitlin, trying to figure out where people have gone. Things are in a mild state of disarray. The lighting in the house flickers on and off, and at the beginning you're not sure if it's going to be a horror game or something else.
Yeah, it really toes that line and plays with the red herrings a little bit.
Sure. I called it a walking simulator earlier. This is because it was one of the first of a genre of games that is a little bit more common and accepted now, where there aren't really many fail states or puzzles to solve. It's just you walking through, examining objects, and taking in the story and your surroundings.
It's impossible to die, isn't it?
I haven't researched it, but you're correct. I cannot think of a way to die if I wanted to kill myself and gone home.
It's not that bad of a game.
It's not usually on my list of things to try in a game, but yeah. I'll have to add it in the future.
But it's first-person perspective in the way that, you know, a lot of popular games, Doom probably being one of the originals, all the way up through Halo and beyond. But you've got no gun, you've got no health bar. You are just kind of looking through the eyes of Caitlin.
Yeah, that's correct. But there are some leftovers from the first-person shooter genre. You can crouch, for example. I think it's relevant for exactly one puzzle. I guess it makes it a little bit more engaging. Anyway, if you've played the game Myst, M-Y-S-T, from how many years has it been, Chad? 20?
I hesitate to make a guess.
Many, many years ago. So if you imagine Myst, but take out all of the puzzles, that's kind of what a walking simulator game is.
Now, was Myst like mid-90s? Is it plausible that Caitlin could have played Myst?
Oh, wow. I did not even think about that.
Let's go down that black hole.
It's possible on CD-ROM. Along with her, what was the name of the encyclopedia? I forget.
Funkin' Wagnalls?
Nope. Think that was
World
a dictionary.
But
moving
one,
on.
One of those big books. Yeah. Yeah, it's a walking simulator. I would call it a very slowly walking simulator. You kind of move at a leisurely pace through the house.
Yeah, that's correct. And it didn't really bother me until later on in the game when I was trying to pick up the pieces that I had missed through the story. And I realized mm-hmm. that walking from the basement on one end of the house to like the attic on the other end took like 15 minutes.
Yeah, and as you unlock more areas of the house gets bigger and you have more distance to traverse and you still walk the same speed.
And you saw some similarities with a recently released game, No Man's Sky.
Yeah, I've been spending a lot of time in there lately. I imagine we'll come back to it someday. But yeah, it's another kind of walking simulator, but with more to it. But it just made me kind of see some common roots, maybe that ultimately the goal is kind of exploration and wandering around and looking at stuff, even if No Man's Sky has a little bit more of the traditional first-person shooter trappings to it.
But there's no set path you're supposed to follow. It's more the game presents a story, and your motivation for going forward is to resolve the story and figure out what happened.
Yeah, you're pretty much just presented with the scenario at the beginning of arriving home and nobody's there, and what do you do?
Yes, and it's a dark and stormy night.
And naturally.
Naturally. So one interesting thing about this game is that if you look on Metacritic, it divides reviews between critics and users. And if you look at the critics' reviews, the scores average 86 out of 100, which, as I mentioned, was 12th highest for that year on the PC.
Yeah, that's pretty extraordinary.
But if you look at reviews from users, they come in at 5.4 out of 10. There's quite a difference between the two, and that's been attributed to a few things. A lot of people have claimed that Gone Home isn't really a game, because, like we mentioned, there's no fail states, which means there's no way to die or lose. The game just keeps on going. And people were also upset that they felt that critics gave it a high score only because of the LGBT themes in the game, which I think, along with the walking simulator aspect, was a little bit revolutionary for it at the time.
Yeah, that's true. I can't think of a lot of predecessors thematically.
So we chose this game for this week partially because of the current political climate. It's an election year, and Chad, you have front row seats to what is currently going on in North Carolina.
Yes, I live in the Triangle area around Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. And if I think it's made it into the national news, our quote unquote bathroom bill, or HB2 is the more technical name, or even more technical, the Public Facilities Privacy and Security Act, which is a great bit of bureaucratic
The
naming.
PFPNSA.
Oh, I hadn't gone as far as acronyming it, but it's a shame it's not pronounceable. I got to get more vowels in there somewhere. But the root of the bill and what got the most press over it is it's makes it illegal to use a bathroom different than the gender on your birth certificate, or unless you've had your gender officially changed by the government. And long story, it would be a whole other podcast by itself, but this came out of an ordinance that was passed at Charlotte that the state legislature overturned. And then they lumped all kinds of other stuff in with it also about it's now, I think we cannot sue in state court for employment discrimination. You have to go straight to federal court, which is more difficult. I think that provision's getting rolled back, but it was in, that's the only part they're rolling back. It also takes away the option for municipalities to pass any anti-discrimination laws, and weirdly, they can't set their own minimum wage anymore. For some reason, I'm not sure how that ties into anything else. But there's been all kinds of business uproars. You might expect the NBA All-Star Game recently announced they're leaving the state. A bunch of businesses have chosen not to come here, not to bring, you know, hundreds of jobs. The economic damage to the state, depending on who you listen to, is in the, you know, hundreds of millions to billions of dollars. And like you said, it's an election year. Not only the presidential race, our governor's up for election.
Oh, I
He
didn't
pretty
realize that.
much. Yeah, oh yeah. And he pretty much signed this bill without reading it in something like 14 minutes after it was passed, and then frantically tried to roll it back. There's one spectacular piece of journalism where he tried to blame it on the fact that the movie Batman vs. Superman was playing in China, and nobody complained about that, even though China has regressive policies, so everyone should leave us alone.
Wait, what?
Yeah, there's really no, like, that sounds like nonsense, but that is literally a thing that he said on national television.
Amazing.
Yeah, but I'm getting sidetracked. I apologize. But like Gone Home, like the criticism and the elements of the law that relate to LGBT issues, specifically, you know, transgender people and what bathroom they can use, has overshadowed all the rest, quite justifiably, the other provisions of the law, and drawn a lot of criticism. So, you know, even though this game's 3 years old, this law was passed, I think within the last 6 months. I can't remember exactly when, but it's still something that's, you know, it's going strong. And I think a lot of the fear and yelling around the law has come from people maybe not being exposed as much to these kind of issues before. And it really seemed to catch everyone by surprise.
Yeah, so it's the game's modern relevance, or I guess contemporary relevance to what's going on today in the political world. But I think looking at it also has value in terms of people designing training or people looking at onboarding programs in their organization. Arguably, one of the objectives of the game could be to make you take the perspective of a homosexual teenager in a little bit different way, perhaps to open up your understanding or your perspective on what their life might be like. So we can kind of look at the game in terms of how successful that is.
Yeah, and I would say we need more of that. One of the things about this law that drives me crazy is if you ask someone, well, okay, let's say you are a transgender person, you maybe were born male and now appear to be female to all exterior observation, and you're now supposed to use the men's room. Like you put yourself in the shoes of the person who is, for all intents and purposes, female and now legally has to use the men's room. It's a very strange situation all around that I think when you try to look at it through their eyes, I would hope at least becomes a little more apparent why it's so strange.
Right, and it's always fascinated me the question of how you get someone to take a different perspective politically, just first to even entertain the notion, and then second maybe to possibly convince someone, because it doesn't seem like that happens very often,
Not so much.
despite people's best efforts to the contrary on both sides.
Yeah, and those Facebook comment threads, they're winning everyone over.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, so many of my beliefs have changed from reading
Day
YouTube comments
to day.
personally. Yeah, day to day. And even if you're not involved in politics, it will probably behoove you to, when you have new employees come on board, for example, to help them to open up a bit more to your company's mission or your company's values or goals. I know that every company probably has them. They're probably plastered somewhere on the internet or the walls or somewhere else. And maybe it sounds a little bit manipulative, but it's probably part of your responsibility to help people identify with those values, and part of that can be affecting them in an emotional way. And we'll be looking at this game to see what kind of techniques it uses to affect people's emotions and how they believe or do not believe certain values. So, with that said, I'm going to start with one person whom, if you went through any type of education preparatory program in the United States recently, you've probably heard his name. His name is Benjamin Bloom. Chad, have you heard of Benjamin Bloom before?
I have heard of him. I have not gone through any of those education training programs myself, but being proximate to people who have
You caught some Benjamin Bloom splash damage.
a little bit, yeah.
So Bloom was famous for his taxonomies, his categorizations of learning activities and objectives. He's most famous for his cognitive taxonomy, where he says that the lowest level of learning is just repeating something by rote or memorization, then it builds up to actually applying something. And at the highest level, depending on what year you looked at his taxonomy, it's either synthesizing the knowledge with other things or judging the application of the knowledge in various situations. But, Chad, can I tell you a secret?
Oh, please, enlighten me.
I'm actually a little bit heretical because I've never found his cognitive taxonomy that useful. I mean, probably its biggest use, in my personal experience, has been something to do with teachers when you bring them in for in-service day.
Because they were all exposed to it in their undergrad days.
Yeah, and for some reason, in service days, in my experience, teachers love to go through categories and put things into categories.
Well, that doesn't sound like librarians at all either.
Yeah. Oh. Sorry. Perhaps I am preaching to the choir. I don't know. Wrong
Perhaps.
metaphor. Anyway, so in corporate training or adult learning, I've often found it more useful just to look at what you want people to do and make that your objective instead of going through and making sure you have objectives at various levels of the taxonomy. The idea of the taxonomy is that you have to be able to do the lower levels, like the repetition and the memorization, before you can do the higher levels, like the application. But I mean, in today's world where a lot of our information and knowledge is offloaded to devices and job aids, I don't know how relevant that is. But in any case, Benjamin Bloom had two lesser known taxonomies.
I did not know this part.
Oh, well, he also has the psychomotor taxonomy,
Yeah, that's a new one.
which was to be used for kinesthetic or physical activities or athletics, and no one really cared about that one. Well, maybe someone did, but I've only heard it brought up as kind of a curiosity on podcasts, for example.
So that one didn't go top 40.
No, it didn't. It was the filler track on the album, which was put out in the 1950s. But his third one, which is what we'll be talking about right now, was his affective taxonomy, and that was to be used for emotional objectives when you want to get someone to feel a certain way.
That does sound relevant to Gone Home.
Sure. So, in this model, the first level of the taxonomy is called receiving, and that means you're basically willing to listen to a point of view or a perspective. So just being able to absorb it and not leave the room, that is the first
That's a low bar, but yes, an
step.
important one.
Yes. Bar is basically on the floor, but that's the first step. The second level is called responding. That means that the person will do something because they're asked to or under duress. So like if you're a student in class and your professor asks you to comment on this forum about how you feel about LGBT rights and you respond to it, you're not doing it because you have a strong intrinsic motivation to do so. You're just doing it because someone asks you, and you're just doing it to avoid punishment or something. That's the second level.
So you know it's what you're supposed to say.
Right. And then the third level is when you progress from doing things because someone asks you to do it to you're doing things of your own initiative. So this is when you start to feel excited about something and you start to maybe organize a discussion group, or maybe you bring it up in conversation on your own, or maybe you start to take that side of an argument without being forced to in class.
You internalize it a little bit.
Yeah, so you're starting to internalize it a little bit more. And then the fourth level is called organization, and that's when you progress from just having this burst of initiative to you're actually doing it habitually, and it's more a part of your lifestyle, and you can kind of track it across time.
So is the goal to always get to that stage necessarily?
Well, I guess it depends. I mean, I think if you're trying to get someone to believe a different thing, I guess the goal is to make it part of that person's lifestyle. So beyond just doing it because someone asks you to, beyond just doing it briefly, to the stage of you can trust that that person's going to have it worked into the actions that they'll be carrying out later. The highest rank is called characterization, which just seems to me to be organization double plus, but I wasn't able to find a good example of how that is different from the other top level. But anyway, you kind of get the idea. So the question then is, how does Gone Home kind of look from that lens? I think with video games in general, probably the best you can ask for is maybe that third level, that valuing level, where someone takes the initiative within the game to champion a certain point of view. I don't know that a lot of games have the staying power in terms of time spent across someone's life to really reflect it at the higher organization level to represent that someone's doing it as part of their lifestyle.
Yeah, I'm trying to think back through my own gaming experience and think like what has affected me that deeply that might change my day-to-day going about things. I'm not hidden much.
I think I've played games or read books where it's kind of been the spark for me to maybe research a point of view in more detail. And
Sure, it's a jumping off point.
Right, so maybe it got me to the level three, the valuing level, and then I kind of pursued it on my own and became more a part of my lifestyle. I think maybe the only example I can think of in terms of sustained contact and sustained behavior change might be, for example, a massively multiplayer online game. For
That's a good
example,
point.
in World of Warcraft, when you get to the end of the game, a lot of times people will have to band together in groups of 5 or 25 or even larger to beat a certain dungeon. And you kind of have to have some teamwork skills and the ability to tolerate other people for you to
I sense
progress.
there's a story behind this.
Well, it's why when I would join those groups way back when I played, I would make sure I joined groups of adults because
That is a good baseline. Yeah.
it stretched my tolerance a little bit less.
So it was more about the social connections that were required at that level of the game, at that level of the taxonomy.
Right, and your willingness to let other people maybe be the star while you worked in a support role, for instance. With Gone Home, I don't know that it really reached a level deeper than you can expect from maybe a book or a movie.
I would
So
agree, I think.
through the game, you're examining objects. You'll pick up, for instance, your sister's VHS tapes or your dad's VHS tapes. You might pick up an audio cassette to see the type of music that her girlfriend's band was in. You'll look at some posters like you do in Life is Strange, and you kind of piece together this story of what was happening in the family, and spoilers are going to follow from here if they haven't already. But you find out that the dad has been having a hard time with his novel writing career, and he's been forced to write pieces just reviewing hi-fi stereos, and that the mom is maybe having an affair with one of her subordinates who is literally called Ranger Rick.
Yeah, it took me a while to realize that was his name.
And you find out that Sam, your 18-year-old sister, is kind of feeling disaffected from her classmates and from her parents, and you kind of pick all this up through clues, but you don't really make any choices.
Yeah, your only choice might be, it's possible to miss a clue and not see it, but that's not really a choice so much as you just happen not to look at it.
Right, so Gone Home, reaches that first level of receiving where it's giving you these experiences, this information, and I guess it's kind of arguable how much it asks you to even respond. I guess there's kind of the internal process of you looking at the different clues and piecing that together, but beyond that, there's no way that you're really participating or making an effect in the world.
It's possible to even, not pick up on any of those sort of side stories. The core narrative would be, Sam's things that you're uncovering, but it would be entirely possible to play through and not even notice what was happening with their parents.
That's true. So I guess if we were to draw the parallel to the aforementioned onboarding programs or trying to get your employees to think about your company's mission and values, I think an example like this is just kind of similar to maybe one of those videos that you might watch when you first start a job where it kind of gives you the beautiful picture of the company and what it wants to do. And I guess it goes a bit further because it's asking the learner to kind of piece together the narrative of the story. And maybe that could be employed, if you have a self-paced onboarding module that you're going through where the person learns about the industry or the company, and you maybe put some quote unquote artifacts in there that show the effect that your company's values have on the customers or the employees. And so the person is kind of discovering that as they go along and they're engaged a little bit in trying to piece together what they mean from a big picture. I guess that could be an option and would probably be more effective than just saying to someone, here are the values of the company. But I feel like there's probably more effective things you can do. You can probably go a bit further.
Would that be things like including customer testimonials and that, as you know, seeing how they experience the values of the company?
Yeah, I think so. A big part of maybe helping someone accept values is showing the result, the why behind those values. And if one of your values is customer care, showing, you know, example of what that customer care meant for a customer, for instance, might go a long way to showing, you know, what that value A means and helping someone, you know, B, accept that value.
Mm-hmm. So you can see how it was implemented.
Right. Because everyone, you know, no one's going to say that customer care is not important. So
we don't care about that one.
But if you show actual examples and, you know, actual, I said the word before, artifacts of the results of that, it'll probably be more affecting for a person than just being a talking head about it.
Yeah, it's all about including the outcomes.
So you talked a bit, Chad, about you might miss some of the stuff about the other family members. Do you want to talk a little bit about the interface that the game goes through?
Yeah. So I think, as we've mentioned, a lot of the story is experienced through the documents that you find. The entire story really is experienced through documents you find. Sometimes you find things that kind of trigger a some narration from Sam, which I think was supposed to be like a diary entry of hers, just being read in her voice, and it kind of plays over as you wander the house. Other times you find crumpled up notes in trash cans, you find cassette tapes that you can pop into players and listen to, you find maps hidden behind walls, there's secret passages all over the house, but the bulk of the story is presented through these documents that you find. And one of my biggest frustrations, so I played this on the PlayStation, I don't know if this was, you played on the PC, right?
I did, yes.
Yeah, so maybe this was a different experience there. A lot of the documents that you find are handwritten, and I found them extremely hard to read. Even on my, you know, not super tiny TV, there's no zoom option built into them. A lot of them are kind of messy handwriting. It kind of drew me out of the experience to have to really sit down and decipher what the words were.
Yeah, that's a good point. I played it on my PC, so the screen was right in front of me, but I can, you know, occasionally I'll just put my game on the actual TV and sit on the couch and play it. And I can definitely see if I'd been playing it on the couch, I would have had a really hard time probably with some of the smaller handwriting.
Which goes back to, I think you mentioned earlier that you might think of this more as a book than a game that you just happen to be wandering through. And I feel like when you're presenting something in text like that, you have to be very aware of the media you're presenting it in. It would be one thing to put these handwritten notes in a book that you have there. I got pretty frustrated at points trying to deal with these documents on the screen.
Yeah, so you have the more authentic nature of it being handwritten, but then you also have the problem that people might not be able to read your handwriting.
And it wasn't universal. Some of the documents you find were typewritten, and those were a little easier, but I still would have really appreciated the zoom option on some of them.
Right, and some of them were in cursive, and some people, I think, have trouble reading cursive. That reminded me of Life is Strange, where it provided me an option to read everything in just plain font. You could, like, click in a certain place, and it would just display it in the regular game font instead of the handwritten font.
Yep, you read my mind. I think Uncharted 4 did a similar thing. And even Bioshock, which this game made me think of a lot as far as wandering around and finding documents. In Bioshock, you find audio recordings of different people, but there was always a text transcription, so they provided you those different media to go through. And at one point, I happened to look at, as I was looking, trying to reference something in the game as I thought about this episode, I happened to look at a Let's Play video on YouTube of someone going through the game that was in French, just because it happened to be the right part of the game I wanted to look at. And I noticed that in the foreign language versions, they have those transcriptions of the documents, I guess just to avoid having to re-handwrite them in French or whatever the language is. But I got kind of jealous of the French version. Not that I speak French, but still.
Well, that's a good point. It raises a usability question where you never want to have essential meaning embedded in a graphic. You always want to have it available in some sort of text alternative. And likewise, if there's audio, you want to have some type of text for people to read if they have hearing difficulties. Yeah, I think this game maybe transgresses that a bit. Unless there was an option somewhere for me to have turned that on that I wasn't aware of.
Well, if there was, they didn't do a good job of surfacing it.
Well, fair point.
So I think I went and looked for it at one point. So if it's there, I missed it entirely.
And I see you also have a note about the... we talked about the walking speed as well.
It is so slow. It is so slow. And there's no option to... I mean, I don't want to be, you know, sprinting through the house or anything like that. I could see how that could mess with the desired ambiance of the game. But I got extraordinarily frustrated at some point when I was in, you know, one corner of the house and had to go all the way to the other. And I realized that was going to take me a solid 2 to 3 minutes, which now that I talk about it, sounds like I'm complaining about not very much. But at the moment in the game, it felt unnecessary.
Yeah, I agree. It was a bit frustrating. And there was no fast travel option.
Yeah. And when you try to think of it from your character, from Caitlin's perspective, you know, she's trying to figure out what her family, what happened to them, her sister, you know, there's hints that maybe she's been murdered or committed suicide at some point, and yet she's just calmly strolling around the house. Oh, what's that? There might be a revelation in this other room. Oh, I'll take my time getting there. Surely nothing interesting could be there that I need to get to quickly. I don't know, it didn't fit with the narrative to me at some points.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they kept in the crouch mechanic from whatever first-person engine they built this on top of, so it feels like mm-hmm. having a run mechanic wouldn't have been that much more of a stretch.
Yeah.
I mentioned fast travel earlier. That's a name for a mechanic where you can open a map in a big game and just pick a place and it teleports you there.
Just like real life.
Just like real life.
Yeah. Overall, I thought it was interesting and maybe a little strange that they didn't include the audio for every document. And part of that may have been because this was a relatively low-budget title. I think that maybe they couldn't hire additional voice actors. But even from an accessibility standpoint, you know, a lot of games have major issues where maybe people who are blind cannot experience them, or with other disabilities may not be able to work the controller. But this one, I think, almost accidentally by being less of a traditional game, could possibly be experienced by people with more disabilities, or, you know, at least be able to sit next to someone who's playing it and still experience most of the game, except for reading the documents, which is the bulk of the game.
Yeah, that's true. There's nothing that requires quick reflexes in the game to mm-hmm. to progress. So, moving on, we talked a little bit about the political ramifications of the game. So one thing that made me think of doing this game this week was I'd recently listened to an episode of This American Life with our dear friend Ira Glass.
Ah, we know him well.
Who was interviewing a assistant professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, David Brookman, where, like me, he was interested in how do you change people's minds on a political issue. Unlike me, he went and did a lot more about it than I have ever done. But the study that he conducted, and this was actually a repeat of a discredited study. So the process here was that they would initially be asked to rate their acceptance of a certain issue. I think they tried talking about abortion in one case. They tried talking about transgender issues in another. And the respondent would see a video of someone talking about their experience having an abortion. And then the canvasser and the respondent would each share a story from their own personal experience about the issue. And that's, I think, where the meat of the method occurs, as they begin to draw from their own personal experience and connect that to the issue that they're talking about. And then after each person shares a story, the canvasser starts to ask questions to get the respondent to think about how the stories they just shared relate to the larger policy of abortion. So the canvasser starts out with the general issue, then goes into the person kind of just passively watching a video, and then goes into a more personal, emotional state by each of them sharing stories, and then they kind of draw those stories back into the broader issue that was raised at the beginning. And then after all that, the canvasser asks the respondent to rate their acceptance of the issue again. And actually, in the case of abortion, there was no significant result. But on the case of transgender issues, 1 in 10 people change their minds to be more accepting of people with transgender inclinations. And this effect lasted 6 weeks later on a follow-up to the study.
That's the most notable part to me, I think, that it seemed to be a longer-term impact.
Right, right. And that's, I think the professor noted that was similar to the shift in public opinion toward gay men between 1998 and 2012.
Oh, wow. Okay, that puts it in perspective.
So the professor's point was that, you know, in 14 years, they had as much progress as these canvassers had in about their 20-minute interview. The points that the professor drew from those results were that he felt that abortion maybe didn't have much of a needle movement because it was an issue that's already been in the public mind for a long time, and people's opinions on that are already pretty well entrenched, whereas transgender issues are somewhat new, and it's easier for people's minds to be swayed on that because their worldviews haven't really solidified on that yet.
Hmm. So does that imply we should be, you know, imagine we had a time machine, went back to, you know, when people maybe didn't have as much of their mindset about abortion, that maybe at that point it could have made an impact?
Maybe. It's possible. I think also maybe abortion can be a bit more of a dramatic issue than transgenderism, just because of the life and death aspect of it, maybe just becomes a lightning rod for more polarized opinions.
But that also highlights the importance then of staying on top of current issues in whatever your area of study or expertise might be. That, you know, that's the time when you can make an impact.
True, yeah. Yeah, very, very true. Before people, you know, pick their kickball teams and stay on them for decades. And the other interesting thing he found out was that the identity of the canvasser didn't matter. So one conclusion of the originally discredited study was that the person doing the interviewing had to have been a person who had an abortion or had to be a transgender person for the method to have any effect. But when they redid the study, they found out that it wasn't the identity of that person. It wasn't really the respondent having empathy for the person they were talking to. It was about the respondent responding critically to real experiences that they've had and that the other person have had.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of ties back into, ta-da, Bloom's effective taxonomy that we were talking about that we were talking about earlier, where I think the original conclusion was that someone just kind of had to receive and respond to a particular type of person. They didn't really have to have anything critical going on in their own mind, whereas this newer study found that the critical point was the person, you know, going to that next step and thinking critically about what had happened in their own life and the lives of others, not just having an example of the person in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean for Gone Home? Well, you can kind of look at the political canvassing as an example of the mind trying to deal with cognitive dissonance, which is a fancy term for when you're thinking two things that don't make sense together, or when you think a thing and you do a thing that doesn't make sense with the thing you think, you have cognitive dissonance. The mind tries to either change your belief or change your actions so that everything is kind of internally consistent. And, you know, as people went through that brief 20-minute conversation with the canvasser, they probably started to have some cognitive dissonance of maybe their original belief didn't really match what they were talking about with this person in front of them, so they had to either change their perception of the person in front of them or change their belief on this abstract issue that maybe didn't seem quite as real to them anymore as this person that they were talking to and the conversation they were having. So I think in Gone Home, the game takes advantage of this cognitive dissonance set up by first creating sympathy for Sam, the main character's sister, and only revealing her homosexuality a bit later in the game.
That's a very good point.
So your first knowledge of Sam isn't, hey, this is my lesbian teenage sister I'm coming home to meet. It's, hey, this is my sister who I haven't seen for a year. I'm reading these examples from her schoolwork that show she's getting picked on by her classmates. She didn't have anyone to talk to because I was in Europe seeing the world. So you start to feel sympathy for her. And these are all just kind of, you know, your basic storytelling techniques where you show someone being in pain that they didn't deserve and you feel bad for them and you kind of want them to succeed or do better in life. And there's other things that make you feel sympathy for her, like you see her short stories about pirates that she wrote when she was 5 or 6. And then you see her try to stretch her creative writing muscles and other ways. She gets an assignment on menstruation. And really the assignment is just write these sentences in the correct order. But she turns it into kind of a story. Were there pirates in that story?
That was wonderful.
And the lines from the assignment were just placed in there as if they were lines from being pulled from a hat on an episode of Whose Line Is It Anyway? and it was really funny. And I thought there was a nice counterpoint later in the game where you see Caitlin, the older sister's example of the exercise, and it's all just very in the right order. She did exactly what the teacher asked, and she got an A+, and instead Sam got the see me response at the end.
Yeah, so that was a nice contrast between the two.
Yeah. So you see someone in pain a bit. You see them trying to achieve a goal, and they're having trouble with that, the goal being to express themselves artistically. And the one person that Sam finally connects with, her girlfriend, she connects with her in a socially unacceptable way. And when her parents find out about it, they kind of refuse to believe it. So the game kind of leads you down this road of feeling sympathy for this ordinary girl who doesn't turn out to be socially ordinary. And I think, you know, by the time you find out what her sexual orientation is, maybe you feel a bit differently, more positively towards her than if you would have found out about her sexual orientation first.
I think you're right. You kind of want her to succeed at that point, regardless of any revelations that may or may not come into play later.
Right. So I think that in terms of the game was well done. And I think the lesson there, if there is a training or an instructional design lesson, is just the simple storytelling techniques that I was kind of alluding to earlier, is that you kind of want to start from a place of commonality with the people you are you're training, or your audience for your training. Again, to come back to company values, if you can maybe pick examples that are easily relatable to the person who's taking the training, maybe something they've seen on the news or a popular place or a popular segment of people, and start from there and build kind of a sympathy or a story around those things, and then progress from there to your company values and showing how, you know, your company values can help people who are in that group or have helped this location or something like that. Then maybe that can be an effective way to approach it.
Yeah, and I think the pirate stories that you kept finding throughout the game, kind of written at different points in her life, highlight maybe a storytelling strength in games. You know, we talk about Is Gone Home a Game, but if this were a movie or even a book, I don't think you would have gotten those whole short stories that you could stop and read and start to get into the mindset of Sam a little bit and see what her ambitions were and what she liked. You might have seen, you know, a cover page or something like that briefly flash by in a movie, but in a game you can provide that kind of side alley that you can go down if you want to. You don't have to read those whole short stories, but as much as I complained about some of the documents, I think I did read every word in those as I found them.
Yeah, and we talked about Life is Strange last time, and we were talking about how the quality sometimes in those found documents wasn't that great. It just seemed kind of mediocre in places, but I felt like in this game all the writing was very well done. It seemed very conversational, very authentic, very real, and I definitely appreciated that.
But yeah, there were no hellas.
What's that?
There were no hellas.
Much less hella ratio.
Despite also being set in the Pacific Northwest. I don't know. Maybe that wasn't a thing in the 90s.
Maybe not. I wonder what the 90s version of it was. but yeah, that's a good point. I mean, when you're writing for video or for a movie or for the stage, it's very hard to get people in your characters' heads because everything has to be spoken. But when you do something that is written, or when you're learning where it's more self-paced, then you can give those more in-depth glances into what's going on. So yeah, the medium you choose definitely makes a difference in what you can explore.
Yeah, and the style of the medium too. There's no monsters stalking you that you have to worry about coming up on you. You can stop and just read the story if you want to.
So speaking of exploring, you had some comments on the linearity of the game.
Yeah, I was trying to decide whether or not it is how linear of a game it is. I mean, it definitely seems to expect you'll follow a certain path, but it also has some of the trappings of open exploration still, where you can go most places in the house. But then you'd run into locked doors, which again kind of took me out of the narrative of why would they lock a wing of the house? I don't know, I couldn't figure that part out.
Yeah, you. I guess if you turn right to the kitchen, the door is locked.
And you eventually come at it from the other side and are able to unlock it, but at the very beginning you can't just barge through in that direction. So it kind of funnels you, at least from the start. Which I can see why they did, because it is a big house that you walk very slowly through. If I haven't mentioned that before, it's slow.
Chad, how do you feel about the walking speed?
I think it's kind of not fast.
that's a good point. I would go to certain doors and it would be locked, and then I'd come around from the other side and they would open. It just reminded me of a more conventional game, like I was playing Dark Souls earlier this year, where a big mechanic of that game is you come to a door, it's not locked, and you go around the other side, you unlock it, and there's a shortcut to the area where you were. And
Yeah, or how many games have we played where you're in some sort of military base and have to find a security pass to open a door or something like that? Like there it makes sense. Here it pulled me out of the narrative a little bit. So it kind of expects that linearity, but then it seems very confused when you go off that path. Like at one point there's a did you find the safe in the basement?
I did.
That were you able to open it?
Not until I cheated.
Okay, so you have to find a combination for the safe. And I'm still not sure where you're supposed to find it. But in that same room where you find it's a very old looking safe, it's obviously been there a while. And if you look around the room it's in, there's a growth chart on the wall, which is supposed to have been Caitlin and Sam's father when he was a kid. I think his height being tracked there because this was his uncle's house. And the last date of the height chart was in 1963. So I decided to try that, and it happened to be the combination. And so I assumed, because I knew it would be 4 digits, and I assumed that because that was written in that room and the safe was right there, that was how I was supposed to find it. And there's an earlier combination elsewhere in the game where you just kind of stumble on numbers and you find them and they work. And I assumed that's how you were supposed to get in. But at that point, like I said, the PlayStation version has added achievements, and I unlocked an achievement for opening the safe without finding the combination first.
Oh.
So apparently you're supposed to find it somewhere else, but I didn't. No, I don't know. I found that very strange.
Yeah, I think it was on the back of some newspaper clipping somewhere in the basement. So in the game, there's your dad, Terrence, and he inherited the mansion from your uncle or his uncle,
His
Mason,
uncle, I think, yeah. Oscar.
and Oscar. And he was a pharmacist who went crazy, and when he died, your dad got the house, and Oscar has a safe down in the basement. And when you go down in the basement, originally Oscar's belongings are kind of mixed in with the rest of the family's unopened boxes from moving. And I found a few clippings from the 60s involving Oscar. So the irony is I put in like 1960 and 1965 because they were dates on the clippings, and then I saw the 1963 on the wall and I thought, no, that's too obvious. The combination wouldn't be right there. That's dumb. And then that was the actual combination. But yeah, so you open the safe.
And well, that was most of what I wanted to say. It's just the game seemed very confused when that achievement popped up that said I hadn't found the combination, but I in fact had found the combination, just not in the way it intended me to.
Oh.
It just kind of highlighted how the game is very, very linear overall, despite the fact that you can take different paths. You're going to miss things if you do. The game is technically possible to complete in less than 1 minute if you know what you're doing from the start, because all of the secret passages are there in the house. They just don't get marked on your map until much, much later in the game. And to finish the game, you end up needing to go into one of the secret passages and find a key to the attic. So it's very possible that the first thing you do when you enter the house is make a beeline for that secret passage, grab the key, go upstairs, unlock the attic, and finish the game by finding Sam's diary upstairs. And in fact, there's an achievement, again, for completing the game in less than 1 minute, which gets into speedrunning and,
And sequence breaking.
Yeah, sequence breaking. It is, despite the fact that it feels very linear, it is possible to go off the rails, but then you kind of lose everything about playing the game or experiencing the story and the points that it wants to make.
So speedrunning is a, I guess, what would you call it? A culture, an approach, a hobby?
Yeah,
we'll go with hobby.
Yeah, hobby slash subculture.
Where the goal is just to beat a game as fast as possible. It often involves using glitches in the game, or sequence breaking is when you go through a game outside of its intended order. And I think the only time I kind of did that was I found a switch in the guest room closet to open up the pathway down into the basement.
Oh, you found that early?
Yeah, I was poking around, being obsessive compulsive about examining closets and clothes, because every time I've played a Myst game, there's always something where you open a door, you go in the room, and you close the door, and there's a stupid thing, you know, you see. Yep. When you close the door. So I was doing that to all the closets.
Well, even back to the original Wolfenstein game, I remember running around hugging walls the entire game because I knew there might be secret passages in them.
Right. Right, so it finally paid off. I finally found a secret passage, although I think if I had just kept following the path, I would have found something a lot less painstakingly. So I think that was not quite the intended way to go, but it didn't feel like it broke the game's storytelling too much.
I found it interesting that they left the option in there. You know, they could have very easily not had those secret passages be accessible until you're supposed to get to them.
Well, maybe that makes the game feel a bit more engaging because you have a bit more control over your destiny in that case, because you found a thing. What kind of application do you think that has? Like, what takeaways are there from linearity versus?
Well, the takeaway for me in this, maybe not linearity in general, but this particular implementation of it, is that when people come to your game or your book or your movie or whatever, they probably, unless they're totally new to a genre or a medium, bring expectations with them.
Mm-hmm.
So my expectations, once I realized there were secret passages in the house, I started looking for them. And because I've played other games where there's secret passages all over different places. And whereas if this was, I don't have a good example that would be interactive that way. But if this was, you know, a movie, I'm not going to go poking at the movie looking for branching scenes on the DVD that, you know, take me in different directions, because that's not how I expect to experience a movie. But the takeaway might be then allowing for or designing around the expectations that people are going to bring to your whatever product you're building based on the broader context for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess that plays into the idea of Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So an Easter egg in a game is something that you discover without being led to discover it in any way, and you feel like you discovered a secret, and it kind of makes you more excited and engaged through the rest of the game, because maybe there's some other Easter egg to discover. And it's usually an inconsequential thing in the game, like you don't really need to find it out. I was reading a book called The Octalysis Framework. Did we talk about this last week?
Yes, I think so.
Maybe. But one of the things the author of that book gives as an example is that some study he cited found that people pay attention to a speaker for as long as they need to until they can categorize him or her in some way.
And then
after they figure out what framework or paradigm to view this person through, then they kind of lose interest. So he gave that as a parallel for game design and maybe interactive experience design, where if you keep your audience on your toes with interesting things they can discover, then maybe they'll be more engaged and be more attentive and more involved. And of course, you have to have something in the beginning of, you know, your self-paced training or what have you to lead a person to that Easter egg, so they feel like they discovered it on their own, but everyone doesn't miss it, you know?
Yeah, because otherwise you put all that effort in for nothing.
But yeah, I think that's an interesting parallel.
The other thing that was on my mind is, as I played through a lot, you know, specifically looking out for an eye toward usability related things, was, have you ever read Don Norman's The Design of Everyday Things?
I've read excerpts from it. It's the book where it has the teapot on the front and the handle is on the wrong side.
Yes, they're very impractical, poorly designed teapot. It's a great book, and Don Norman is the guy who pretty much invented the field of user experience. I think he was the first person to have that in his job title at Apple back in the day.
I didn't realize he worked at Apple. All right.
Yeah, I don't think it lasted long. He went on to bigger and better things. But this was like early 90s, probably. So right around the time Gone Home was around, he was doing his thing. But one of the big things he talks about a lot is discoverability and the idea, can you understand how something works just by looking at it? And there's a bunch of concepts he goes into in the book about that. I'm going to mention at least a couple of them without getting too lost down the rabbit hole. But there's the idea of affordances, which is what an object or product can do. So, you know, a door can open, a button can be pushed. And then an object has signifiers, which help make those affordances obvious. So a door can open, but until it has a handle or a doorknob, you don't necessarily know which way the door is going to open. In fact, some very poorly designed doors, you don't know which way they're going to open. But you can design around that by putting a push bar on them that's obvious. You push that door, you don't pull it, and end up like the Far Side cartoon.
Yeah, as someone who routinely pushes the wrong side of the push bar.
you are not alone, my friend.
I very much enjoyed that section of the book.
Yeah, and I ran across then an interview, or it wasn't an interview, a presentation done at the Game Developers Conference in 2014 by Steve Gaynor, who was one of the writers, or he may have been the writer and designer in Gone Home. Mm-hmm. But he talked very specifically about some of these concepts and how they applied them. So, for example, you can find all the VHS tapes through the house. And so what are the affordances of a VHS tape? You can put it in a VCR and play it in real life. And they didn't want people, especially with the parallel that there are cassette tapes you can find in the game and pop them into cassette players and play them, they didn't want people to be expecting that you could play the VHS tapes and see videos. So they removed all the VCRs from the house.
Oh.
And if you look around, there is not a single one at any of the TVs. So there's VHS tapes everywhere, but there's no VCRs. You can even see the little like AV cables poking out beneath the TV.
I was reading online about that, and I think someone offered a story justification for Sam stole all the VCRs before she left the house so that she could pay for her road trip or something.
I actually, as I played through, I assumed it was something related to the father's AV reviewing, that, you know, maybe he was getting ready for new things to arrive or something. I don't know. But so that was something they very consciously kept in mind as they designed, that if you're going to have these objects people can interact with, they're going to have affordances and signifiers that people bring to them and expect things to be able to happen. And if you don't want them to, you know, wander around trying to figure out where they can put that taped off TV X-Files season one cassette or VHS tape that you find under one of the TVs, you shouldn't give them a VCR to put it in.
That seems awfully involved. I mean,
yeah,
slightly picayune subject, I think, maybe to devote so much time and thought to. You know, like,
and
just,
you know, this is what he said in the presentation. Who knows? Maybe they just didn't want to model VCRs. I don't know. And this was the retrospective
fair
explanation
enough
for it. Yeah, but one thing they did really well, more broadly as far as game interface goes with signifiers, was when you can interact with something, it kind of lights up a little bit as you get close to it. And it's a subtle effect. It's not something I even consciously noticed at first as I went through. But like, if there's a door that you can't open, when your little cursor kind of rests on it, it turns a, I don't call it white, but it kind of lights up for a second. And then you know that there's something you can do with that object that you've gotten close to it, as to distinguish it from some of the background stuff that you can't necessarily interact with.
Oh, really? So even when your cursor is not on things, the stuff you can interact with is a...
No, sorry. Just when your cursor rolls over something that you can't interact with. And again, this may be a difference between the console and PC versions. I'm not sure. With the PC, I assume you're pointing and clicking with the mouse to do things?
Yes.
And with the PS4, when I played that version, you know, you have to move the camera and there's a dot in the very middle of your screen. And when that dot rests over something, the object kind of gets highlighted if you can interact with it.
Huh, that's interesting. And maybe it might be in the PC version. I just totally didn't notice it. But it could also be maybe in console versions. It's kind of more difficult to, you know, aim at things than it is with a mouse and keyboard. So maybe they put in that extra help for people who are using consoles.
Yeah, which comes back to designing for the medium that you know people will be experiencing it in. even if, you know, you and I played the same game but had different experiences across the different devices that we played it on.
True.
Some other things Don Norman talks about are, you know, an object has constraints, which they kind of implemented through the idea of locking doors, and, you know, fixing the walking speed, for better or worse, turned out to be a constraint as how you could progress through the game. Some of the other stuff in the book is maybe not as relevant for talking about Gone Home in particular. But another thing I thought they did really well that Don Norman talks about in the book is that an object should have feedback, or notifying the user that the system is working towards something. So at one point, you're trying to find the locker combination for a locker in Sam's bedroom. And you find a piece of paper that has been torn in half and has part of a combination on it. And there's a little note that pops up that says, "You found the first half of the locker combination." Well, that's great. Now I know there's only one more piece that I'm looking for, which from just looking at a torn piece of paper may not necessarily be apparent. And I maybe could argue that maybe designing the torn paper better could make that note unnecessary. But it was one example of keeping me appraised of the progress I was making through the game that I thought they did pretty well. I knew what my context was, what my goal was at that point. And to contrast with that, one thing I thought they didn't do so well with feedback was, so as you progress through the game, you have a map of the house that you can refer to at any time. And as you just make new discoveries throughout the house, new things get marked on your map, the locations of secret passages, which is great, makes them easier to find. But the secret map kind of notes are not checked off in any way as you find them. So sometimes multiple secret passages are added at once, and this may be my personal limitations more than anything else, but I would get really confused about which I had found already and which I hadn't.
Yeah, I had that same problem a little bit, but I think I didn't realize there was a map for a while, and when I found it, I was so happy that there was any map at all that I gave it maybe some more leeway. I mean, well, I grew up playing games where to play them you had to have graph paper.
Back in my day.
Back in my day, we didn't have auto mapping. We had graph paper and pencils.
But then I got very bitter that it wouldn't show me where I was in the room. It would only tell me which room I was in.
Oh, really?
This is, again, my own sense of direction more than anything else, but I would get very lost in the living room and not know which exit would take me to which place.
That's true. Yeah, I felt that a bit upstairs where, for instance, Sam's bedroom has multiple doors for some reason out.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to orient myself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that these are good points to bring up, because at least one thing that I've struggled with making e-learning is that you want to use real objects in your e-learning to simulate like an actual like cash register environment, for example. And so you'll have a lot of maybe things in the environment that are there for just background and seasoning, but not actually something people have to interact with, right? So the challenge is to show people what is something they can interact with versus what is just background eye candy.
And I was impressed in this game how much of the background eye candy was interactive.
Well, maybe even in too much. So.
Yes.
I don't know, because like the game started and I was like picking up every single cup and rotating it and looking for secrets.
Oh man, I can see the recipe on the bag of potato chips. Is that a clue? What?
Yeah, but I guess, I don't know, I guess having so much extraneous stuff that you don't need to pick up then conditions you to not pick up everything, so when you do find something it feels a bit more organic than you just wandering through picking everything up because it's your job, which maybe that's just me, but if it's possible for me to examine every room or read every poster or pick up every cup in a reasonable amount
of time. I must collect all of the Kleenex boxes in the house.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, so I think the challenge when you're, you know, designing something interactive is that those signifiers that you talk about, those knobs on doors and, you know, the tape decks and so on, you have to kind of play against that, where people are conditioned to think that this thing does something, but then you have to have another layer on top of that for your game that separates the things that can be acted upon versus the things that can't. And, you know, oftentimes a little highlight, like you were talking about, I think, does the trick.
Mm-hmm.
So, how can we summarize our experience with Gone Home, Chad?
I don't know. I mean, I think that we're not trying to be reviewers and give it a positive or negative overall. I thought it was really interesting, and I know that sounds like a milquetoast way to kind of evaluate a game, but especially, you know, thinking of it in as a game out in 2013. I thought it did really interesting things with expectations of what a game can be and kind of using that media to tell a story in a way that I hadn't necessarily seen before, again, at least not at this level of distribution and artistry.
Sure. Yeah, I think some takeaways from it are how to tell a story through the environment, which I think a lot more games have started doing that in a similar way recently. Even more action-oriented games, like I mentioned Dark Souls before, which is just straight up a game about killing dudes with your sword. But the story is told almost exclusively through things that you find in the environment and you piece it together. And I think the story ends up being a lot more powerful because of that. Going on a little bit of a tangent here, but I ended up reading a book about the Dark Souls series of games where it just tells the narrative of it, you know, from beginning to end. And the narrative was like 3 pages long and it seemed kind of trite and cliched. And I thought, well, was that it? But as I was going through the game, discovering all these pieces, I felt like I was uncovering a mystery and it seemed a lot more, you know, powerful and big.
Yeah, I did feel like I had agency in it, as, you know, going back to linearity again, I maybe didn't have a lot of agency ultimately, but they made me feel like I did.
Right. So, you know, when you're designing something, maybe think about that as a storytelling device, not just delivering your message from beginning to end in a static way like a book, but, you know, taking it into pieces and having it be found and giving some of the agency for that to the user to piece together. I think the other takeaway for me is to think of having an effect on people's emotions and values through that kind of step-by-step process of either creating some type of dissonance, some difference between how they feel about something that is now real to them versus how they feel about that thing in principle, and helping someone reconcile things that way. Or looking at things in that step-by-step way of, okay, first we're going to help people just to, you know, receive this point of view, and then maybe start to take very small actions toward that point of view with the goal of getting them to want to take those actions, because we've kind of brought them to that step through a series of gradual transitions.
Yeah, I like the idea of thinking of an experience like this as part of that process.
And I think this segues into the game we will be covering in our next big installment, which is Papers, Please, which I think kind of takes things to that next level where you're not just receiving something and seeing something take place or even piecing a story together, but you're being asked to take action within that story and make choices that will affect people in that story. Based on whether you decide to help them or to leave them to struggle. And I think that kind of takes things to the next level of involvement that we kind of saw in that canvassing study from before.
And plus, if Gone Home was a walking simulator, Papers, Please is the best bureaucracy simulator that I've ever played.
Yes, Papers, Please will be so much more fun to delve into, not just from the emotional aspect, but it's also basically a training simulator, only somehow it's a game. It's a training simulator for a job that doesn't exist. Well, it does, but you wouldn't want to have it. Anyway, we've whet your appetite enough. If you don't go out and download Papers, Please before our next episode, you can hear us talk about it. But in the meantime, it's been great talking with you. I've been Brandon Carper.
And I've been Chad Haefeli.
And have a good day or a good night. Goodbye.